This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 29, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll go to Capitol Hill, where the Senate is voting on a watered-down lobbying reform bill. The ACLU files a class-action lawsuit against a school district for maintaining a hostile environment to Native American students. And students in Houston, Texas, demand that Congress move on the DREAM Act. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Israeli Interim Prime Minister Ehud Olmert today began the process of coalition building after his presumed victory in yesterday's election. During his campaign, Olmert promised to define Israel's permanent borders by 2010. Yesterday's election turnout is said to be the lowest in the country's history. The U.S. government severed all ties with the Palestinian Hamas-led government today, minutes before its official swearing-in ceremony. Leila Haddad has more from Gaza.
In an email directive it distributed today, the American government instructed its diplomats and other officials not to have contacts with Hamas-appointed government ministers, whether they are members of the group or not, according to American officials. The no-contact policy, which took effect just before 6 p.m. Jerusalem time, applies equally to those who work for the ministries but are not Hamas members, such as independents and technocrats in the new government. The United States hopes to pressure Hamas to recognize Israel and renounce its armed struggle. Hamas officials have urged the United States to modify its stance and not punish the Palestinian people for their democratic choice. The group's leaders have also said that Israel has not yet recognized Palestinian rights nor abided by peace accords that should have afforded Palestinians a state long ago. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor has been extradited from Nigeria after attempting to flee the country. Sema Lakoya reports from Lagos.
Charles Taylor was arrested this morning while trying to escape from Nigeria, where he had been living in exile since 2003. Taylor had attempted to flee the country after Nigeria agreed to his extradition. Policemen arrested the former Liberian president at a border town while trying to cross into Cameroon from Nigeria. His attempt to escape was a major embarrassment for the Nigerian government. President Olusegun Obasanjo, currently in Washington, D.C., subsequently ordered his immediate extradition to Liberia. After landing in Liberia, Taylor reportedly boarded a helicopter bearing a United Nations emblem. Taylor is expected to face trial at a UN-backed war crimes tribunal in Sierra Leone. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
French workers and students' unions have set a date for another day of strikes and protests against the government's youth employment scheme. And the Education Ministry has ordered police to be called in to reopen high schools closed by protests. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
After mobilizing millions on the streets yesterday, 12 workers and students' unions today declared that April the 4th will be a new day of action against the first jobs contract, the CPE, which allows employers to fire workers under 26 years of age at any time. For its part, the Education Ministry has ordered high school principals to ensure that all classes are held as from tomorrow morning. Official figures show some form of protest in well over a quarter of the country's 4,300 high schools. So the Education Ministry has told principals to bring in the police if necessary to end occupations or pickets that have paralysed 318 of them. Students in the western city of Rennes, a stronghold of the protests, today blocked the main roads into the town. Police used tear gas to clear them. With socialist representatives in the National Assembly after his blood, Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin again refused to scrap his plan but said he's ready to discuss improvements. And as pressure mounts for the president to intervene to end the crisis, officials have let it be known that Jacques Chirac will make a statement in the next few days. So far, he's backed up de Villepin, whom he appointed as Prime Minister. It's not yet clear when he'll make a declaration. Tomorrow, the Constitutional Council rules on a socialist claim that the contract breaks France's promise of equality of opportunity to all its citizens. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair has been the most vocal world leader in pushing for cuts in greenhouse gases. Yet today, his government has admitted it will not meet its own pledge on cutting CO2 emissions. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Tony Blair's government had pledged to reduce Britain's carbon emissions by 20% by 2010. But UK emissions in 2005 were higher than in 1990. Scientists, environmental campaigners and politicians have described Britain's efforts as pitiful, accusing the government of lacking the political will to tackle global warming. Alongside recent announcements on such things as the widening of motorways and building of new airport runways just in the last few days, the government has lowered its emissions target. But many argue that unless more radical policies are adopted, even a 15 to 18% reduction by 2010 will not be possible. Governments should be scaling up their efforts, not scaling them down. And it all leaves the national and the global effort in a sorry state, say campaigners. Tony Blair has said he'll push for a new international framework to replace the Kyoto Protocol when it expires at the end of 2012. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Former lobbyist Jack Abramoff was sentenced to nearly 6 years in prison for fraud related to the purchase of a casino boat in Florida. In a separate scandal, Abramoff was indicted for three felonies related to his lobbying practice. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate has passed a lobbying reform bill that Congress has labeled as crucial to changing the nature of politics and governance in Washington. But, as Leon Caldwell reports, according to senators and political analysts, the bill has been watered down and includes little context to offer real change.
Even though several members of Congress have been associated with indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who pled guilty to three felonies in his lobbying practice, both Democrats and Republicans raced to the pulpit calling for reform. They say the influence of lobbying in lawmaking is too great and it needs to change. Although the influence of lobbying is hard to measure, the presence is getting larger. Lobbyists spent $2.2 billion on persuading lawmakers on policy in 2004. That's according to the Center for Responsive Politics. That's more than any other year in the past. So the Senate responded by taking up a lobbying reform bill. Republican Senator Susan Collins from Maine praised the overall legislation.
It is a strong bill that I believe will help to enhance public confidence in the integrity of government decisions.
The bill increases transparency in lobbyist-lawmaker transactions. Lawmakers will have to post on their official public website some interactions with lobbyists, including trips for which lobbyists paid. The bill also makes it more difficult for former congressional staff members who have become lobbyists to lobby their former boss. And it bans the funding of all meals and gifts. But there lays a loophole, and that is that a lobbyist organization, not the lobbyist, can pay for the dinner. But that loophole is not the only problem with the bill, according to some, including many senators. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon.
I'm sure not going to be issuing any press releases saying the job is done when this bill becomes law.
One of those issues of concern is a lack of a nonpartisan Office of Public Integrity, which would investigate charges of lobbying rule violations. Mary Boyles is a spokesperson with Common Cause.
A lot of the excesses that we saw in the Abramoff scandal were things that were already against the rules. We saw as key to this, the whole reform community, as key to any kind of serious reform is an outside body to monitor and make sure that rules of Congress are followed.
The provision was voted down by a vote of 67 to 30. Opponents in the investigative body say it's not needed, that the Senate Ethics Committee is nonpartisan and capable of conducting its own investigations. The number of investigations by the Senate Ethics Committee is not made public, but the House Ethics Committee has not met in 2 years. That's despite indictments of former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay regarding lobbying and campaign violations. Earmark reform is also missing from the Senate bill, which is considered crucial to some. Earmarks, also known as pet projects, are amendments added at the last minute that often go unnoticed by Congress, staff, and the press. Last year, 15,000 earmarks were added to bills, totaling somewhere around $50 billion. That's more than any other year. Republican Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma said that earmarks and lobbyists are directly connected,
and he wants to ban them.
Earmarks are the gateway drug to overspending and fiscal mismanagement. They create a wedge under which you have an earmark, so therefore you cannot dare vote against something that you otherwise would vote against.
The bill that passed would make earmarks be posted for the public to see for 24 hours before they are voted on. Republican Senator John McCain from Arizona hoped to make that provision stronger, but it was stripped from the bill. Senator John McCain.
Oh, I think we have not seen the last of this issue, because I think there's going to be more indictments.
The House has not yet begun their version of lobby reform. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Though Iraq's Kurds were freed from the repression of Saddam Hussein's government in 1991, journalists continue to fight for free speech in the autonomous region. FSRN's David Enders files this report from Sulaymaniyya in Iraqi Kurdistan.
We have to
Farhad Auni, the head of the journalist syndicate in Erbil, holds up a copy of the independent Kurdish weekly newspaper Hawati when asked about whether the Kurdish government permits free speech in the local press.
In their last issue, they have published an article that talks about the Kurdish leadership. They are calling them Pharaoh-like. The article tells the Kurdish leadership to leave Kurdistan. This is just their view. They are free to write this article. According to the law in Kurdistan, this journalist's rights are protected.
The next day, Hawaz Hawazi, the journalist who wrote the article, was arrested by Kurdish security forces and beaten. Azad Jindiani, the spokesman for the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the party whose security forces arrested Hawazi, was unapologetic.
He's not a journalist. He's only written two articles.
Hawazi's colleagues were able to bail him out of prison a day later, but he still faces charges. The paper, with a circulation of 16,000, has continued to raise government heckles in the wake of the arrest, and this week's issue condemns the arrest and the continued Kurdish government campaign against free speech in the wake of anti-government protests in the city of Halabja a week ago, in which demonstrators were fired upon by security forces, killing one and injuring at least 10. Halati's editors have also filed a complaint with the Committee to Protect Journalists, an international press rights group. Tiari Rath is the international editor of the Iraq Crisis Report, which is published by the London-based Institute for War and Peace Reporting, whose Iraq office is located in Sulaymaniyya.
Generally, the frustration I hear is the lack of respect for free press from the leaders. And so what happens is, if, let's say, you're trying to do a story on corruption, well, in the U.S., maybe we would work our sources and we would do a FOIA request. No such thing here. There's just no transparency. Then if you can't get an official to talk to you, or even a mid-level bureaucrat to confirm that there is something going on, corruption, maybe there's even just a general problem in the ministry, if you can't get confirmation of that, then you can't write the story.
The Kurdish government is also proposing a law in the region's new constitution barring speech deemed against the Kurdish national interest. Similar laws have been used to incarcerate journalists in nearby countries, such as Egypt and Turkey. Marwan Hama Said is a local journalist and the Kurdish editor of IWPR's Iraq Crisis Report.
And now, as I say, it's getting worse. The journalism code they are doing now, it says you cannot write any article against the interest of national Kurdish nation. I mean, Dr. Auni says there is freedom of speech. What kind of freedom of speech? If you are arrested and you are beaten, and if you are being called terrorist.
The Kurdish government does, however, seem to respond to international pressure. In October, Kamal Said, a Kurdish professor who had been living abroad, was arrested upon arrival in Kurdistan. Government officials said the arrests were related to articles Said had posted on his website accusing government officials of corruption. Last month, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. After coverage of the arrest and sentence appeared in the international press, the government said it would retry him. In Sulaymaniyya, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. The scandal surrounding the Geneva-based Global Fund has not only caused the resignation of Executive Director Richard Feetchum, but is affecting thousands of patients who would be fund beneficiaries. The Global Fund suspended 3 grants to Uganda, citing corruption, and the country has now instituted a commission of inquiry into the alleged mismanagement of billions of Global Fund dollars meant to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. FSRN's Joshua Chalimpa reports from Kampala.
Lack of money now to enable people to do these necessary tests means that even the drugs that may be available may become useless.
Major Lubalamira Ranga is the head of National Guidance and Empowerment, a network of people living with HIV. Every year in Uganda, people die from tuberculosis, malaria, or AIDS. According to Ranga, many are dying due to the lack of medicine.
Actually, the issue is not only about HIV, but it's also about malaria and tuberculosis, because these are very, very closely associated. So many people are dying now because of lack of medicine for tuberculosis. And of course, the question of HIV is even worse, because even the drugs which were made available may not be used, because people cannot manage testing for the CD4 counts and the viral load. And these are a prerequisite for any person to go on to the ARV treatment. Reason is that people must know, the health workers must know the level of infection at which the individual is.
Rose is among the hundreds of expectant HIV-positive women who turn up for antenatal care at the Joint Clinical Research Center in Kampala. The Joint Clinical Research is a center that offers treatment under the Global Fund. While waiting for care, Rose helps carry a baby for one of the mothers who is getting treatment from the doctors. She's worried that the scandals may cost her baby if she doesn't get nevirapine, a vital drug administered to pregnant women, so that their babies will be free of the disease.
It was in August when I decided to have a child using nevirapine. You have to swallow it when you're in labor. That one helps to reduce the infections or the virus that may affect the child at birth. I used that because I thought having one child in the earth, I thought it was not good.
The problem of HIV/AIDS is still very serious in Uganda, and all the programs do not cover all the people who are in need of the life-saving treatment. Figures from the Ministry of Health indicate that 67,000 patients are accessing antiretroviral therapy in Uganda through both public and private sectors. Professor Peter Mujenyi is the head of the Joint Clinical Research Center, a center set up by the Ugandan government to provide HIV treatment. He agrees that there are still problems in the Uganda AIDS campaign, but says the Global Fund scandal is not the cause.
All the donor programs in Uganda do not yet meet the national requirements. There are still more people in need of treatment who have not yet been reached by all the programs in the country. So anything which interferes with the immediate address of so many people who are in vital need of this life-saving treatment obviously impedes the country's goal of universal access.
The storm at the Global Fund was sparked by allegations of conflict of interest involving the wife of the executive director of the fund. Naram Sekri, wife of Richard Feetchum, is a health specialist who owns a consulting firm, Healthcare Redesign Group, based in the United States, which has been named in suspicious deals with the Global Fund. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The House of Representatives is debating federal assistance to students attending higher education today. Many student activists and college administrators are pushing to defeat the bill, which will be voted on tomorrow. FSRN's Darby Hickey reports from Capitol Hill.
Republicans and Democrats traded barbs over the Higher Education Act reauthorization today, each painting themselves as pro-education and their opponents as misguided. The act is reauthorized every 5 to 7 years when Congress can rewrite the terms of federal financial aid to students attending colleges and universities. Democratic members of the House said today that the rug had been pulled out from under the bill by passage months ago of deficit reduction legislation, which cut over $12 billion from federal student aid. Ranking Democrat on the Education and Workforce Committee, George Miller of California, was the first to call the bill a missed opportunity that doesn't do much for low-income students.
Because when I say this bill, understand, I talk about both bills. You split them for the convenience of what you wanted to do with your raid on student aid. But this is the higher ed bill. The monies were skimmed off in the name of the oil companies. The monies were skimmed off in the name of tax cuts to the wealthy. So we don't have the ability to make that investment.
Republicans, such as Chair of the Committee Howard McKeon, said the Democrats were playing partisan games with education legislation. The bill will address a changing higher education environment, McKeon and others said.
And we were, as I said, working together until yesterday when they said they had decided, and I can only assume it's for political reasons because it didn't come up until then, they decided that they were going to go back and talk about something that happened months ago rather than what is in this bill, the good things that we have in this bill.
Student groups such as the United States Student Association oppose the bill and say President Bush's 2007 budget reduces funding or flat funds student aid. They are calling for a National Day of Action on April 5th to demand Congress prioritize higher education access and grant aid. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a class action lawsuit in federal court against the Winter School District in South Dakota. As FSRN's Jim Kent reports, the ACLU charges the school district has maintained an environment that is hostile to Native American students and disciplines Native students more harshly than their Caucasian peers.
Representatives of the ACLU and the Rosebud Sioux Tribe held a press conference in Sioux Falls Tuesday to announce a lawsuit that ACLU attorney Catherine Kim says has been coming for some time.
We've been documenting what's going on in Winter for more than 2 years now. It has been a very, very grueling process of identifying fact after fact of discrimination and school-to-prison pipeline policies.
The ACLU alleges that school-to-prison pipeline policies include suspending Native students from minor disciplinary problems, as well as referring these problems to local law enforcement. Kim adds that the principals in the Winter School District have regularly forced Native students to sign confessions of violating school rules. Those confessions have then been turned over to local prosecutors to use against the students in juvenile court. The ACLU statistics show that Native students in the Winter School District are 3 times more likely to be suspended than Caucasian students and 10 times more likely to be referred to law enforcement. On more than one occasion, Native students have been taken into police custody without notification being given to their parents. South Dakota resident and non-Native Deb Phillips is embarrassed by the reports of how Native American students are treated in the winter schools.
If we are to live up to our ideals, if we are going to be the people we want our grandchildren to admire, then we have to be willing to extend the same rules to how we treat the original residents of this state. We can no longer be blind to how some in our state treat Native Americans. We have to stand up and say enough.
Dana Hanna is the Attorney General for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. Hanna says in the 5 years he's been working on this case,
I learned that there was a culture of institutional fear of Indian children, and that regular, totally predictable, totally natural school kid misconduct was being aggressively prosecuted by the school administrators and the prosecutor in the town as crime.
The class action suit demands an investigation of and an end to the Winter School District's discriminatory practices. Calls to the Winter School District and its attorney were not returned. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Hot Springs, South Dakota.
Thousands of high school students in Houston, Texas, continue to walk out and march today against pending immigration legislation in the U.S. Senate. Although Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist will introduce his harsher immigration reform bill to the floor, the Senate Judiciary Committee will introduce its version as well. The committee's bill includes the DREAM Act, which will provide undocumented high school students a path toward citizenship. Rachel Clark reports from Houston, where students recently gathered to urge Congress to move on the DREAM Act.
Jesus Narvaez, like hundreds and thousands of other teens across the country, anxiously looks forward to graduating this May from high school. He is full of hopes and aspirations for the future.
Well, I plan to attend University of Houston and try to get a teaching degree so I can become a teacher. I want to teach math because for some reason it's easy for me. And right now I am currently ranked 37 in my class out of like 400 students.
Wow, so that's top 10%.
Yeah, that is top 10% right there.
There's something beyond being near the top of his class, though, that also separates Jesus from many of his peers.
Yeah, I came here when I was about 7 years old, but I've been living here since then. Most of my life has over here. I've lived over here more than I have over there in Mexico, but still can't do anything because of that problem.
The problem is that Jesus is undocumented. In 2001, Texas became the first of 8 states to grant students like Jesus access to both state financial aid and in-state tuition rates. But as undocumented University of Houston student Sandra Carrizales explains, no matter how high their class rank, they still are excluded from most scholarship opportunities.
And I received actually 2 scholarships in high school that were really good. They were able to be renewed after if I had good grades, and I couldn't receive them. The lady that I talked to, she didn't know much about, I guess, situations like mine, and she told me, when I told her, hey, I don't have a Social Security, can I still get my scholarship? She's like, well, why don't you have one? And, oh, well, just call us back when you get one. And, of course, that wasn't going to happen.
It's not going to happen because, on average, it takes undocumented persons like Carrizales 10 to 12 years to legalize their status. Graduating with a university degree is also bittersweet for the thousands of university students without papers. All college graduates get butterflies as they ready to enter the workforce. But, as Sandra Carrizales shares, she graduates in December facing additional obstacles.
It's more questions, you know. Even though I want to think of good things coming, you never know. It's the uncertain, you know. Other people graduate, they know, they don't have the questions that I have. They can just go and apply for different jobs. It's whether they'll hire me here or there. And I'm trying to figure out whether someone will even look at my situation and try to do something about it and see how qualified I am and be able to go through the immigration process that needs to be done. And if there is one, because laws are changing.
The debate around what changes to make continues on Capitol Hill and in living rooms across the United States. To learn more about this and other issues facing undocumented persons, you can visit the web at www.justiceforimmigrants.org. Reporting from Houston, Texas, I'm Rachel Clark, Free Speech Radio News.
And that will do it for today's edition of Free Speech Radio News. FSRN is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Antonio Ortiz, and Eric Klein, who is the proud father of a new 8 3/4-pound baby boy born yesterday. Congratulations to Elza Nyeri and Eric Klein from all of us here at FSRN. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.